Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time. MASH was aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is Lieutenant Britt Eisner. Hi, Britt.
Hi, Rob. Great to be here.
Great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So we're going to be talking about the season six, episode six, The Light That Failed, which originally aired on October 25th, 1977. But Britt, since this is your first time on the show, I have to ask you, how did you become a fan of MASH?
So my previous history with MASH is that I had heard of it before for years and years and years, because I went to film school and we did study it in some of my like television history classes and whatnot. And I've always known that my grandfather watched it a lot when my mom was younger. So I had sort of like heard about it on the outskirts of stuff, but never thought that much about it. But a little over a year ago, it was on Hulu. And I feel like I've seen every sitcom under the sun. I've watched a lot of television. And I was looking desperately for something new to watch. And I started watching it around Christmas time. And I became instantly hooked on it. And I think that part of what kept me going with it is both that it was something that I could really talk to my mom about and my dad about, and even my grandfather. It like brought us a lot closer together. Like I had reasons to be like calling my grandfather and talking to him every week about the show, which was really special. And then my roommate that I was living with at the time got slowly hooked on it as well. So because the two of us were sitting down every night when I came home from work, watching three or four episodes, it really kept me motivated to keep going with it. And obviously the show just extremely appealed to me. So yeah, we watched every season all together, and the rest is history. I was extremely, extremely hooked on it for the past year.
So, okay, I'm always fascinated by people that have, that are catching on to it much, you know, much later after it has come and gone. As we talk about, it's been off the air for 40 years now. And so when people that are a lot younger that latch onto it, what is it about the show that you hooked into? I mean, obviously you had the familial kind of connection, which is a nice enough thing by itself, but what was it about the show that, you know, here talking a show that's been off the air for 40 years, that's about an era 20 years even before that, what was it that appealed to someone so much younger than the typical audience for the show?
Well, I think there are a few factors. I mean, one, which I know that Pomegranate said earlier when they were on the show the other week, that they've been into older media for a long time. And that's true of me too. I've always been really into 60s and 70s art and music and television and film. So there wasn't a hurdle for me with that, where sometimes I know when people aren't used to watching stuff that's like quote unquote older, it can be a little harder to connect to it, but I never really had that struggle because I'm super familiar with stuff of that era. But I think topic wise, what hooked me on it is that, you know, I have like an aversion to war related media because I think a lot of it tends to be pro-military propaganda and stuff. So since I was younger, I was really, really against all of that. And I would never think of interacting with something that was like a war show. But I started watching it anyways to, you know, try it out. And I was just completely shocked and totally blown away that I had never heard the political position that the show takes, which I think is this very like nuanced look at war. And it's, you know, it obviously has that like anti-war element. And so that really, really appealed to me. Like my favorite novel of all time is Slaughterhouse-Five, and I've read it 1,000 times. And I think a lot of the themes and energy and intention behind MASH harkens to that kind of thing that's always appealed to me. So I think that I was shocked because I didn't expect it. And all of these things that I heard about it from my family and from school and everything, I felt like I had never heard that and never heard it mentioned. And even when I started watching it, my mom started rewatching it, and she hadn't seen it since she was a kid. And she said herself that she was surprised and hadn't even remembered that from when she was a kid and seeing episodes of it. So
That's great. That's fantastic that she was able to find something new in it decades later. You know, that's marvelous. I had that same experience when I was a kid. I watched it for certain things. And then as I got older, oh, wait a minute. Hold, there's this whole other thing in here. Do you have a particular favorite era of the show? If you want to define it that way, like what sets of characters you tend to like a little more than others?
Sure. I mean, BJ is my favorite character. So even though I do really like the earlier seasons as well. And I love Trapper, but I'm totally there for BJ and for Potter as well are favorites of mine. But it's hard because I always want to say like season four and stuff, but I also love Charles. So I think it's like in that like 4 to 7 almost, which okay. is a big span of the show, I know, but that's when I was the most enthused about it.
Well, that lines up perfectly with you being here for season 6 then, doesn't it?
Yes.
All right. Well, excellent. So as I mentioned, we're here to talk about episode 6 from the season, The Light That Failed, originally aired October 25th, 1977, written by Bert Proletsky and directed by Charles Dubin. So supplies are running low at the 477th. Gel foam, sutures, winter clothing, even light bulbs are becoming very scarce. A supply truck arrives carrying nothing but useless items, salt tablets, an ice cream churn, insect repellent, and the like, leaving the 477th up a creek. The one interesting item is a package for BJ, a mystery novel. Since everyone is so bored, a spine-tingling paperback is like pure gold. BJ crawls into his cot, savoring every page. When Hawkeye grows frustrated that BJ is taking so long to read the book, he tears out the first chapter and throws it to Hawkeye just to shut him up. The book then starts to make its way around the camp, first to Winchester, then to Potter, then Klinger, then to Nurse Bigelow, and so on. It becomes the topic of discussion in the mess tent. The only problem is the book is missing its last page, leaving the identity of the murderer unknown. BJ insists he knows who the killer is, the Reverend Butterfield. In post-op, Winchester, in the middle of complaining about working conditions at the 477th, gives a patient the wrong sedative, curare, instead of morphine, causing the young man to go into shock. Hawkeye and BJ pull him through, but Winchester, whom Hawkeye refers to as a major disaster, isn't even thankful for the help and is unwilling to take even the blame for giving the patient the wrong drug. Meanwhile, an argument over the identity of the novel's murderer breaks out after BJ concludes that his first guess was wrong. He makes a second guess, but Nurse Bigelow points out that that's wrong too. After more numerous wrong guesses, they get so frustrated that they place a call to the novel's author, who is a 97-year-old woman living in Australia. They call her, and she tells them the real murderer. After hanging up the phone, they realize she's wrong too. Later, Hawkeye continues shunning of Winchester drives Winchester nuts, leading to an argument. While Hawkeye admits, technically, that Winchester is the best, his lack of actual feeling for his patients leaves a lot to be desired. Another supply truck arrives carrying all the stuff the 477 needs. With the tension eased, Winchester finds it in to apologize to Hawkeye for his behavior, promising to think more about his patients from now on. All right, Britt. So this is The Light That Failed. I should mention that the title is taken from a Kipling book from 1890 called The Light That Failed. Pearl, what did you think of this episode?
Honestly, when I was thinking about it in retrospect over the past like few months preparing to record this episode, I was like, oh yeah, I really liked that episode. I love that episode. And then I rewatched it twice last night and I like the book plot line, but overall I was like, I actually don't know how I feel about this one. I was a little torn. I didn't love the Charles plot line, actually.
Okay, so why? Why is that?
I felt like it was that they were sort of writing him as Frank a little bit and not fully characterizing Charles. I mean, they get to that point at the end where he, has to like talk about his skill versus how he feels about his patients and whatnot. But I felt the initial blunder in with the patient in post-op was a little out of character.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I was reading about that curare was never, but you know, I mean, MASH gets details wrong, so we're not going to get too upset about it. But I did say that curare was apparently never approved for use in Korea. So it never should have been there in the first place. And curare is a paralytic used in conjunction with anesthetics. So there'd be no reason for it to be in post-op. So, okay, right. There's that. There's those problems there. Now you could argue, you know, things are loose at the 477 sometimes, and a bottle that got put on the wrong tray, ended up in post-op or whatever, whatever, whatever. I will say, I do think that during some of the episodes of season six, they are still trying to figure out who Charles is. Mm-hmm. I think David Ogden Steers had the character down on paper. Like he knew what he was, being handed and he knew how to play it. But I think the writers were still casting about a little bit for where he was exactly. And while I kind of agree with you a little bit that, yeah, I think that is such a huge mistake that it is almost like, really, would Winchester make that kind of mistake? Like he would literally not look at the bottle of a, you know, that he's about to inject into a patient. That's a huge mistake.
I think the reason that they sort of give for it is that it's because it's like too dark in there.
Right.
Right. That he couldn't read it because it's too dark, which then also, if that is the case and that was the reason, and he does say that, then obviously it was a huge blunder, but everyone is like way harsh on him about it. And it's like, well, I couldn't read the bottle and maybe he should have gone to a light and tried to read it better. But I don't know. It just felt a little convoluted.
Yeah. It's like, well, I mean, right. I mean, I would, if anything, I'm about to eject into somebody, I would make sure I knew what it was.
Right,
you know,
get
up, look at the light. Come on, you Winchester. Like, what are you doing? You know? But yeah, this is definitely one of those episodes where it's a very heavy A and B plot where the B, you know, the one plot is kind of not silly. I mean, the lack of supplies is a big deal, but it's, you know, life at the camp kind of storyline. So the stakes are a little lower. And then the Winchester story is obviously much more serious. Now they blend them together with the idea of they're out of light bulbs. And that's why the post-op is so dark. This is kind of a nice way to merge them together. MASH wouldn't always do that. Sometimes their A and B plots were just completely separate. But there's a little bit here of like, yeah, I would imagine working for Winchester, he's not used to any conditions like this. And it's almost like offensive to him that it's like I'm expected to perform under these conditions, under the freezing cold, no light, no, I mean, they talk about in the opening scene in the OR that there's like, they're running out of like sewing thread. I mean, basic stuff. So it's kind of a nice merging of the two, but it is, especially the whole bit with the book is very silly. And then the other stuff is very, very serious. And that's something MASH would do throughout the rest of the run of the show.
I love the bit with the book.
So they, as I mentioned, there's the opening scene in OR, and they talk about that they're running low on supplies, and Winchester is already complaining about everything. Then the supply truck arrives, and they see, by the way, no radar in this episode. Klinger is doing all of the company clerk stuff. Again, you know, when he takes over for Radar in season 8, how is he so inept at this job when he's been doing it kind of every fifth episode in season 6, but okay. So anyway, the supply truck arrives and they see that all the stuff in there is completely useless. It's mosquito netting and, like I said, an ice cream churn, things like that. I should mention that the supply clerk who is insisting that Potter sign for all this is played by the marvelous character actor Philip Baker Hall in one of his earlier roles. You've seen him in movies like Boogie Nights, Magnolia, The Insider, The Truman Show. You know, he's just one of the great character actor careers of all time, and here we see him very briefly at the top of the episode and then later at the end. And he is one of these guys who is probably like an army lifer who, and Potter even asks him, like, didn't you wonder why you were bringing like an ice cream churn to a medical unit? And he's like, yeah, I used to worry about stuff like that, and then it gave me headaches, and now I don't worry about it anymore. He doesn't care. His job is to deliver the supplies. That's it. That's all he cares about. He could care less about the meaning of any of it, which is probably, you know, a nice way to go through life.
I loved his delivery of that line. Like, I wrote that down. I used to wonder about stuff like that, but it kept me up at night. Like, I thought that was great.
He's like, I'm getting to go home. I'm getting back to the base tonight. I don't care. I don't know what else is going on. I absolutely don't care. So, I love, he says, you know, think about the bright side. Summer is just 6 months away. So like incredibly depressing. So, and we say that, as I mentioned, there's a package and it's for BJ, and it is a mystery novel, The Rooster Crowed at Midnight by Abigail Porterfield. That is a absolutely fantastic fake book name. Probably just did the Agatha Christie kind of word generator and put it together, but it sounds like a real book. You know, it really.
I want it to be a real book or a real movie. Somebody should try to adapt it.
There you go. Right. Yeah. Yeah. The Reverend Butterfield and stuff. So let me ask you, related to this episode, have you ever had that experience where you have picked up a book and you literally couldn't put it down? Like you're just so wrapped up in it that you just did it all in like one or two sittings?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's why I, like, in retrospect, loved this episode and was thinking about it, because this whole aspect of the book and everyone at the camp getting so excited about the book and needing to read it was something that I really related to. Because I'm not as good at reading now, because reading as an adult is much harder than reading as a child, I found. But when I was a kid, I was an insanely avid reader, and I would regularly sit down and read an entire novel in one sitting. So I really related to the like excitement and addiction that they all felt to, you know, keep up with the story.
I mean, part of it is that they're bored, you know, right. They have nothing else to do. But of course, you know, it's great. I mean, that's the kind of book you would want to read, like a, you know, a page turner kind of thing. And I've had that experience too, where I picked up a book and I didn't know what I was going to get. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, I've read 300 pages of this thing already. There's a great line where Hawkeye is mad at BJ for how long he's taking. And then BJ can't stand the whining anymore. And he rips a chunk of the book out, throws it over to Hawkeye. And, Hawkeye says, boy, reading, this might even be better than sex. And Winchester says, certainly takes longer around here. And BJ says, how would you know? Which is like a typical BJ joke to kind of like ding Winchester for clearly not great with the ladies here at the fourth episode.
I honestly think that when I watched this episode for the first time with my roommate, Corny, we reround that segment of Hawkeye squealing over the book. A book. I'm so excited. I could plots. I think we might have watched it 3 times in a row because we found it so charming and hilarious.
He's like a little kid with that stuff sometimes. Yeah. He did season 5 with the movie. They got the movie in, and I think he says literally like the same kind of thing. And that's a very childlike trait of Hawkeye's, that he could just lose himself in some piece of entertainment that he's just really, really excited about.
You know what? I'm thinking now, though, it's interesting that Hawkeye has that line about how reading is like better than sex, but he is like so salacious in this episode ladies.
Absolutely. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, because this is, first of all, this is a really great Nurse Bigelow episode,
yes,
played by Enid Kent. She gets a lot to do in this episode. And overall, this is Enid Kent's, Nurse Bigelow's best season. Like, she gets more to do across season 6 than any other season. Now, not jumping too far ahead, but like, I think her finest moment is in the final episode. But she gets a lot of fun stuff to do here. And it's interesting because it leads into the next scene where Winchester comes to Margaret's tent to read her a chapter from The Rooster Crowed at Midnight. This is Margaret's sole appearance in the episode, is this scene. And all the other sequences that would normally you would think would feature Margaret feature Nurse Bigelow. So yeah. I don't know what happened. I assume Loretta Swit had to leave for some reason, or something came up where she was, because obviously they wrote her into the episode for this scene. And then all the other scenes, you're like, that really should be Margaret. Nurse Bigelow.
I know, she must have had something going on.
Yeah, something. So as I mentioned, Charles comes in and he offers to read the chapter of the book to Margaret. Now, first of all, he mentions that he has great eyesight and he can read in the candlelight. So what was the problem with the curare then?
That's true.
He says, I can see a cat before he sees me. So yeah, he's kind of full of shit there about the whole post-op. But anyway, so he reads this chapter to Margaret, and we see that the book is a little bit of like a slightly Jackie Collins, you know, potboiler, bodice ripper kind of thing, where, yeah, it's a mystery book, but it's also got some kind of, you know, slightly salacious details of it. And I will say, this reminds me of something from my actual life, in that for many years when I was a freelancer, I volunteered every week at a organization called the Associated Services for the Blind, which was a company that had to proof books that had been turned into Braille. because apparently if you get government funding for this kind of thing, you can only have X number of errors in any given translation or you lose your funding. So what these books needed to be done was a person who could see had to read the original text, and then a person who was blind would read over the Braille and proof it. And if there was a mistake, they would note it. So I was paired up with a wonderful woman named Diane, a kindly older lady. She had her wonderful seeing eye dog Capri, and we would get together every week and I would read from the book and she would proof it. And then we would continue on the next week. And we read all sorts of things, children's books, manuals, but once in a while we would get a romance novel. And more than once, I had to read sequences that I was uncomfortable reading to this nice, kindly older lady who was as sweet as could be. And there was points where I would literally get to a word and I would say, Diane, I'm not reading that. And then she would run her fingers over the Braille and go, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I got it. So
that's great. Oh, my gosh. That's so funny.
So when I see this scene and I see how uncomfortable Charles is getting using the whip and stuff, I was just like, yeah, that's kind of where
which
I
we
was
know Margaret this. Loves.
Yes, right. We she's getting really into her flimsy black negligee. Her naked is a golden tinted paradise. And I love the look that Margaret gets as he's doing, where she's sort of staring off into the middle distance, kind of imagining something.
She looks just, her face is so funny in this scene. I think they're both hilarious in this scene. David Ogden Stiers is like the king of delivering every line that they give him. But I love his when he adjusts to a whisper when he reads it normally, and then it says he whispered and then he whispers it. It's very funny.
They're trying to figure out, I think, Charles's character. They still haven't decided whether they're going to do something with these two.
Thank God they didn't.
Yeah, thank God they didn't. But again, I think it's because, like I said in a previous episode, these two actors just have no sexual chemistry together. They just don't. It's not a knock on either one of them, because Loretta Swit actually had sexual chemistry with Larry Linville. As tough as that is to believe, because he's Frank Burns, she did. She and David Ogden Stiers just do not radiate that at all together. So I think they realized, this feels obvious, but it's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
I'm
grateful that they didn't do anything with them. And knowing what you know from behind the scenes, that they seem to have had a special friendship too, David and Loretta. So
yes.
they have good chemistry together in all their scenes as actors, but thankfully for the characters, and because it didn't work, not romantically.
Yeah. I mean, we've all seen movies, romantic movies where people are supposed to be couples and you're just like, I'm not buying this.
Right.
I'm just not buying this. Other movies, you're like, wow, these two are great together. But, and again, it could be any sort of chemistry, it could not just sexual. It could be characters that are supposed to be brother and sister, or, best friends. And you're like, these two just don't feel like best friends to me, that kind of thing. So then we go to the mess tent and we're getting to the end of the book, and BJ learns that the final page is missing. And I absolutely love how the way this is set up, that as Hawkeye is reading the final, the final page, right? The reveal of the name of the killer is quite literally the next word on the page. I mean, I know that works for comedic purposes, but it's so funny that you would literally you get the book and the murderer is literally flip the page and there's the
page. Oh, it's totally devastating. If I was in that situation, I'd be like kicking down the door to the mess tent.
And I like the sort of meta Dada-esque humor of, he's talking about Inspector Langley, and he says, if Inspector Langley hadn't taken time to light his pipe, we'd know who the murderer was. He's sort of like editing the book as he's going and stuff. That is incredibly. Who would mail? I mean, who's mailing BJ this package? Presumably Peg, right? Why would you mail someone a book with the last page missing?
I saw a theory when I was Googling around about this episode last night. I saw people talking about it on Reddit, and somebody said, my personal theory is that Peg is a little bit of a practical joker too, and she ripped out the last page on purpose.
That's interesting.
Which I don't know if I entirely buy into, but I do think it's funny.
I never thought of that. It could be now that you're mentioning practical jokes, and now I'm thinking, is it Leo Bardonero from the last laugh episode?
Oh my gosh. He's
getting back. He's getting one back at BJ for getting the non-gassed up Jeep or something. He sends him a
book. Now that I would totally buy.
Yeah. Right. That I could sort of see. So of course that sends everybody into, you know, hysterics because they want to know who the murderer is. And BJ assumes that he knows who the killer is because he says, oh, I've deduced these. I've read hundreds of these things. The murderer is Reverend Butterfield. And oh, okay. All right. And they think, all right, it's totally plausible.
How am I going to tell Father Mulcahy?
Yeah, I'm going to tell Father Mulcahy. So then we go to post-op, and we have the scene where Winchester orders from the nurse some morphine. And the nurse, and I can't tell which nurse it is. It might be Enid Kent, but I can't exactly tell. And she, you hear her say, in a minute. And that's sort of funny. Like, I'm surprised that any of the nurses talk to the doctors like that, that they don't just immediately get up and help them. But I think maybe it's because Winchester maybe has not endeared himself to the staff
right
at this point. So he gets a little more attitude than anyone else would because he's Winchester.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Although he's a major. So she should probably respond.
Probably. And a doctor. You know, you probably should.
Yep.
Now, I will say they do sell it in that the post-op is very dark. I mean, they've actually really taken the lights on. I mean, you can look over like Winchester's shoulder and see the other beds behind him. And it gets pretty dark.
Yeah.
So, okay. You know, by the way, the patient is an actor named Gary Irwin. He was in A Facts of Life in 1986 and nothing since then. So I don't know what happened to him after that. So Winchester sticks him with the needle and he immediately kind of like roils over and something's really wrong. And they said he's hardly breathing. He talks about the morphine and then Hawkeye grabs a bottle and he says, is this what you gave him? And he says, this is Curare. Didn't you read it? And they realize that's, oh crap. And then they go into an absolute panic and try and resuscitate him, which Hawkeye is able to do. But the problem, of course, here is that Winchester doesn't seem concerned about it at all. He is worried about how badly this reflects on him. And that's, you know, that's going to be the hook of the second half of the show, is that he doesn't really seem to care very much about this patient on anything other than an academic sort of turn. Now, I will say, again, from my personal experience, I have had doctors who, I don't know, don't seem to care that much. You know what I mean? Like they come in, they kind of read things at you and then they leave. I'm assuming you've had that experience as well.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't need a doctor to be a psychiatrist for me or anything, but I've had a couple where they really are talking at you, not talking with you. And that's always left me a little frustrated because I'm like, well, this is my health I'm kind of dealing with here. I really need, a couple of minutes from you.
I know. It feels very like isolating, especially for this poor guy in this situation that he's in, like in the middle of a war zone. And he's just like, ah, I don't care.
Hawkeye saves the patient. He revives him. Winchester kind of refuses to really acknowledge anything of what he did. BJ tries to talk some sense into him. And he says, you know, the man would have died without Hawkeye's interference. Hawkeye's jumping in at the last second. Mm-hmm. Winchester, again, refuses to take any sort of blame for it. But I always know that you could tell almost by the body language that David Ogden Steers is doing. He's got a clipboard and he's kind of furiously scribbling with a pencil. Like he knows what he did was really bad, but he can't admit it to himself.
Mm.
Did you get that vibe from that scene?
I do, because I think he starts acting a little like awkwardly too. Like it does feel like almost a little bit of like false bravado and false confidence that he's like trying to speak with, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, he's
and then
very,
you know, and then he ends up chasing Hawkeye all around the camp looking for absolution about it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Yeah. He deep down he knows what he did was wrong, but right now he just doesn't want to he can't bring himself to admit it. He can't admit it that he made a mistake. A hard way to go through life. Those are people mostly on Twitter now. But now we go back to the mess tent and everybody is arguing over the book. That's where we get Nurse Bigelow says, "Do you want a woman's opinion?" Which I can, you know, I don't know. I have not had the good opportunity to speak to Enid Kent. She's been on MASH Matters and stuff. I can imagine if you are a day player, like the nursing staff was, when you get this much to do, when you get the script and you get this much to do, this must make you as an actor so happy that you get to be this heavy into the episode. I mean, they're all at the table arguing about the book, and then she literally inserts herself into the conversation. She's like, "Do you all want a woman's opinion?" Like, she must have been like, this is it. This is Nurse Bigelow's moment.
And she does it so well, too.
Yeah, she does great. She's terrific. Again, I don't know why it's not Nurse Kelly. I'm always rooting for Nurse Kelly to get more.
Oh my gosh.
Don't get ready.
Yeah, we were huge. We knew, me and my roommate, as we were watching, we were always, every time we saw Kelly, it was like, "Woo, Kelly!" And we knew she had her big episode coming up in the later seasons. So we were always counting down the episodes until we got to her.
Yeah. I'm always rooting for her. Always rooting for her. Then she even gets a solo scene essentially by herself, where after BJ realizes, "Oh, wait a minute, couldn't have been Reverend Butterfield, it was somebody else," because there's a secret panel in the house, which he just kind of makes up, really. He even says it's not even in the book, but he's like, you know, old houses like this always had secret panels. Like, well, that's okay. Like, you don't know that in the book, BJ. But then we cut to an outside scene of BJ in the officer's latrine, and Nurse Bigelow comes by, knocks on the door, and she's like, "It couldn't have been the nephew Randolph, because he suffered from vertigo, and he got dizzy if he stood on his toes." And BJ's like, "So?" And she's like, "He never could have climbed out on the roof and dropped the gargoyle on Sir Winslow." Which gives wonderful details of this crazy book. And you know that, you know, we can hear BJ's voice, but I'm going to assume that Mike Farrell was not really there, that they just dropped that in later. So, like, that means Nurse Bigelow gets a whole scene all to herself. It's like fantastic. No one else in the scene, like, not even in, like, Good Morning in Goodbye for an All Men. Everyone's behind her when she has that wonderful speech. But here, like, for that moment, the only person on the sheet was Enid Kent. It's so exciting.
It is exciting. It's, like, unusual for that to happen, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So then we go back to post-op, and Hawkeye is talking to the patient, and he talks about how he ended up getting wounded. And he says, you know, we were in the snow, and you follow the footprints in the snow, because, you know, that guy walked somewhere that he was all right. And he followed the footprints. And then he says, finally, the footprints kind of stopped as the snow turned to slush. And he has this great bit where he says, you know, "I didn't know where else to go. I didn't know where to turn. But then I thought anything had to be better than standing there freezing to death. I was wrong." And, you know, obviously he said he takes one or two steps and then a landmine blew up. And that's what landed him there. It's a great, great little speech. You know, idea of just dealing with what it's like to be out there in the, you know, in the literal war, and standing there and being like, "Oh, well, now what?" You know,
he delivers it in such a chilling way, too. Like, he has that 1,000-yard stare and just monotone. Like, it really does. I recently got, which, of course, it's a very serious scene, so I don't think that there's obviously any laugh track on it anyways. But I recently got the DVDs to start watching the show without the laugh track for the first time. So last night when I rewatched it, I watched with the laugh track and then without. And I don't think it was super relevant in this episode. I didn't actually notice it that much at all, but it is one of those things where it's like, oh gosh, there's a really serious, serious moment that sort of like takes the rest of the humor out of it, you know.
What did you think about watching it laugh track via non-laugh track?
Honestly, I don't want to say I didn't notice, but it wasn't I don't know. I feel like I'm not a person that the laugh track ever really bothered me necessarily. I feel like I don't hear it as much, even when I was watching the show through for the first time. And I've watched a few other episodes with the DVD without the laugh track. And I know that this is like an uninteresting answer, but I feel like it didn't really affect me that much.
That's good. I grew up with it. You know, I've always listened to, heard it on the laugh track. So I actually, when I watch it without it, it feels weird. It almost feels like too quiet. At the same time, if you're not used to it and then you hear it, it is surreal because you're like, who are these people? Where are these mysterious ghost people? Like, it's not Friends or Seinfeld where they're clearly doing the show live in front of an audience. And that's right. But like, who are these mysterious people laughing at this stuff? It is very, for people that have never grown up on laugh tracks, it's surreal.
Right. Which, like, of course, I've seen a lot of shows with laugh tracks before because, like I said, I've watched a lot of sitcoms and a lot of older ones too. So it wasn't totally jarring in the sense that, like, oh, I've never heard a laugh track before. And then when it comes to the show as a whole, I actually I like the laugh track. Not in the same way because you're used to it and that's how you were used to hearing it, which obviously the first time I watched the show, I also watched it with the laugh track. Mm. So it does sound right to me because that's the way that I initially saw it. But I also think it makes it, it's kind of that thing where you've probably talked about this before, but it's one of those things where when you have it, it makes it more impactful when it's taken away. Mm-hmm. So the episodes where there is no laugh track are even more impactful because there usually is a laugh track. And when they're in the OR and there's no laugh track, it's more impactful because there usually is a laugh track.
Yeah, like Quo Vadis Captain Chandler has no laugh track throughout the whole thing in any version. And it makes the episode like that much more stark because you're like, wow, this is where the joke would normally be. And now there's just nothing. You're like, okay.
Right.
So speaking of that, kind of related is that in Winchester comes in, starts talking to Hawkeye about the case and Hawkeye just blows him off. And then Winchester is obviously gets upset and he follows Hawkeye out into the compound, kind of having a one man conversation. He keeps asking Hawkeye questions and he's like, you know, is this any excuse for what I did? And Hawkeye is just not answering him. In fact, he's not even stopping. He's just walking away and Winchester's following him. And it's a curious choice. And I mean that in a good way, but it's a curious choice on director Charles Dubin's part to stage it out here as opposed to going into the swamp. It's just a very interesting. I don't exactly understand why, but it's effective in that they're outside having this kind of angry conversation when you would think, you know, we could just have it. Maybe there's something about that. It's so cold and they're all bundled up that it gives an even more kind of like attention to it. But I just found it interesting to stage it across the compound. We don't see a lot of that exactly. And I will say this argument does have some real tension to it. I mean, you can tell that Hawkeye gets genuinely pissed at Winchester. And he starts calling him, you know, he starts insulting him and he gets the word back bay in there. Like then he gets interrupted, but he's genuine. Like Alda really brings some great tension to it because he is genuine. Hawkeye has no time for this from Winchester.
Well, I think with the staging of it like that, I think it does create this like building tension because Hawkeye is walking with so silently with such a purpose, like not looking at Charles, and Charles is sort of like scurrying around him. And I think that you get more of a sense of, you know, what Charles wants from Hawkeye and how Hawkeye doesn't want to engage with it. And it all builds that tension of up to Hawkeye's almost like, I mean, it's not, almost an explosion that he has against him. You know, he's about to go into the swamp and just be like, oh, I did so good. I ignored him all the way across the compound. But then it's just the final straw. And he almost gets to have like slamming the door on him, but in reverse, you know, and he finally whips around and starts yelling at him. So I can understand like them walking across it was sort of this build of the tension rather than if they'd been still in the swamp, you almost feel like Hawkeye might have just stood up and left and then Charles will be left alone in the room, you know, but this, he almost can't escape him and they're both going to the same location. So he can't just turn around and walk away again.
That's true. Yeah, you're right. If it was in the swamp, there wouldn't have any sense of movement to it. It would just be them sitting on their cots, you know, maybe yelling at each other. But yeah, here he's chasing around. And as you say, Hawkeye finally gets so mad that because he opens the door to the swamp right when Winchester is like, you know, it takes a big man to admit when he's wrong. And that's what finally is the straw that breaks the camel's back. And Hawkeye slams the door and turns around and again, this insult And he talks about, you know,
the superior sturgeon, I thought.
Yeah, you're a superior sturgeon. And Hawkeye even says, you know, look, I don't give a damn about your feelings. And by the way, I love pointing this stuff out. It's very pedantic, but I enjoy it. The reverse shot of Winchester makes no sense, because when we see Hawkeye yelling at Winchester and we are over Winchester's shoulder, they are right in front of the door to the swamp, right? They are like right in that little, like the little strings that come down that tie the tent down. They are right there. But then when you cut back to Winchester, the one of the latrines is like 4 feet behind his head. And you're like, wait, the latrine doesn't go there, because the swamp would be bumping into it. So they shot the reverse at a different time, and they didn't, it just staging was. But every time they cut back to Winchester, I'm like, wait, why did they walk a couple of feet over to continue the conversation and then walk back to the swamp to do the other half of it? It's just, again, it's very silly, but I know.
No, I mean, I work in TV production, so I feel like I watch a lot of TV with such a hypercritical eye of like the shot to shot continuity, and that kind of stuff does. I didn't notice that one, but that kind of stuff flags for me all the time.
Yeah. I love finding things that where the MASH unit is just constantly moving. I love all that stuff where it's just like, wait, how did that get there? Wait a minute. Why is Margaret's tent now 2 feet away from Potter's tent when we saw it? Was that, you know, it's only from having seen these shows 40,000 times that I noticed this stuff. So Hawkeye has this great little bit where he says, you know, yeah, technically you're the best, but if I was wounded, I would want Potter or Honeycutt to work on me. Mm-hmm. They bust a gut to save a life. And he says, you won't even work up a sweat. If the he's like, without an audience, you just don't care. And, you know, that gets to a thing that I've always heard about some doctors and some surgeons, is that surgeons are surgeons because they're not great at the bedside part of it. Mm-hmm. They're great at the technical. They're great at the cutting and the sewing and the this and the that, but they're not great at the one-to-ones. And of course, you know, that could be the kind of thing where Winchester, as we know, was working at Tokyo General. Presumably he was, you know, he was doing surgeries there, but maybe he didn't have to do a lot of that patient stuff. Now, obviously sticking the patient with the wrong drug has nothing to do with rapport with your patient. That's just carelessness. But it's an interesting, to me, it's an interesting development that Winchester, aside from being working at a unit in a war zone, has to deal with patients in a way he maybe never really had to, or purposely got into surgery to get away from, because he knows he's not particularly great at it.
Yeah, which I think that this is, I mean, kind of an early look at what is a really interesting character arc for Charles throughout. Like, this is one of the reasons why I like him so much, because I think throughout the seasons you sort of see him like learning and growing and changing a little bit. Not that he changes immensely, but there are some episodes, I think, in the later seasons where you see him starting to connect with his patients more, and it being very painful for him to connect with them. So I just think it's like a compelling a character piece, and it's different from, you know, the other doctors on the show. I don't think it's entirely something that is, well, it's a bad thing in the sense that, yes, you want him to be more compassionate towards his patients. And we certainly believe that all doctors should be more compassionate to their patients. But I do think it's just like an interesting personal journey that they explore with him.
Absolutely. Cut to the swamp later on at night. Hawkeye's still kind of just sort of mad at Winchester. BJ shows up and says, hey, you know, forget about him. Here's a kind of nice distraction. We can call the author of the book, Abigail Porterfield. She's still alive. She lives in Australia. We can call her and find out the identity of the murderer. Now, again, you know, just because I've seen these episodes 40 million times and this stuff jumps out of me when it for a normal person, it would not. Is we know how tough it is to get a phone call put across.
Yeah.
At the 477, and they can call Australia over a book. Like, how many favors from Sparky did they have to call in to patch that through? Poor BJ can't get a call into his wife, and they're going to call Australia? Like,
and they have no problems with the call either.
Yeah, the connection is good. Yeah. Like, what, you know, okay. What is that about? That's just very funny. I'm like trying to go into Potter. Like, do you mind if we call Australia? You're like, oh, all right, okay. So then there's a great, you know, bit of phone comedy from Mike Farrell in this, and that he's talking to Abigail Porterfield, who is clearly a little, I mean, we said she's 97. She's a little on the dotty side because she's asking about Sun Yat-sen and Pearl Buck and where can she send a card and all this stuff. And, you know, BJ's trying to desperately keep her focused on the task at hand, and she's veering off in all directions. I will say I've experienced that myself. I have interviewed people for my podcast over the years where they're here to talk about a specific subject and they keep veering off. I will not say who, but I interviewed a comics pro once, let's say, on a specific topic. We talked for 2 hours and I think I got maybe 4 sentences of usable material on the subject because this person just could not stay focused on the topic at hand. So I'm like, yeah, all right, I've been there. So again, he's talking to Abigail Porterfield, and then she reveals the murderer. Well, first she says it's this person, and then BJ's like, there's no character like that in the book. Oh, okay, all right. So then finally she reveals another name, and they're like, oh, okay, that's finally, you know, really, who? And, you know, BJ reveals, okay, now we know the murder's been revealed. That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Porterfield. Thank you so much. And he, you know, gets off the phone with her and he says, okay, great. You know, it's all been solved. They walk out, and then Potter has a kind of interestingly pissy line.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah,
too.
Where he says that Avery Updike, by the way, is the murderer. But Potter says, next time you get a book, rip out all the pages, which is sort of like, is he annoyed at all this? You would think this is kind of good for morale to have the whole unit also worried about this thing.
Throughout the episode, he didn't seem irritated with it either. Like, there are some scenes where he is engaging in the conversation about what's happening in the book a little bit, I think. So then at the end, when he was just like, all right, let's never do that again, I was, huh?
You know? Yeah. Yeah. It seems like, why is it? I mean, again, you would think giving something for the whole unit to care about, that's not making them depressed is a good thing. But okay, whatever. But then, of course, Potter goes right back on it, where he gets on the, after the supply truck arrives and they actually deliver stuff that they need, he gets on the PR system, and he says, I hate to put a damper on your supply party, but I got some bad news for you. And then he says, Avery Updike couldn't possibly have killed Sir Winslow. And I love the little self-satisfied look that Harry Morgan gets on his face, where he's like, you know, he's really happy with himself. He figured that out. So Potter is back on the mystery book train, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like it must just be like maybe a line that in the writer's room they thought it was a funny joke, like tear the pages out, but it doesn't really have much connection to his character.
Potter's annoyed that he had to get up in the middle of the night and approve a phone call to Australia or something.
Yeah.
So again, as the supply truck has arrived, and Philip Baker Hall makes a second appearance, where he they deliver all the proper things. Hawkeye goes on this whole rant about, I got Sir Winslow and you're next. And then he grabs Nurse Bigelow and kind of puts her in a clinch. Now I will say, in syndication, they cut out almost everything with Nurse Bigelow.
Really?
Almost all her scenes are cut. And this scene at the end, where Hawkeye says, Sir Winslow is first and you're next, and he grabs Nurse Bigelow, that's where they cut the episode. It ends at that point. But if you watch the full one on the DVD, he goes on for a little bit more, and then they clearly are going to go off to Nurse Bigelow's tent. But all that, so whoever made the syndicated edit in the Philadelphia market did not like Nurse Bigelow, because he just cut all that stuff out.
Terrible.
Yeah,
she's such a great part of the episode.
Yeah, she's finally given something to do, and they cut her out.
Some y'all who's just like, no thanks.
No, Margaret. No, she's not staying in the show. So then we come to the button scene where we're in post-op, and Winchester is working with, again, Nurse Bigelow, and again, she's in the show again, and he's putting a bandage on this patient, and he sees Hawkeye come in, and he realizes what he's done is wrong, and he apologizes. Not realizing, with a little bit of physical comedy, that he has not let go of the roll of gauze that he's holding on. So the whole thing is like stretching across the entire length of post-op. Hawkeye points it out to him. Winchester kind of smiles, realizes what he's done, and he asks Nurse Bigelow, he's like, Nurse, can you handle this? And it ends with Hawkeye laughing at Winchester being so silly. So everything's been patched up by the end of this episode. Yeah.
I did really like that Hawkeye had a big grin about that. I thought it was nice.
Do you feel as though that Winchester, it worked? Hawkeye's speech worked on him? Is that what it was, that he finally, because, you know, like, did he learn that on his own, or did Hawkeye's speech have some resonance to him?
I mean, I think it's a little of both, because like we were sort of saying before, I think he does have more awareness than he's letting on about the fact that he did something wrong. But then, you know, Hawkeye, I think it's part of it because he's so new at the camp too, that I think he does want to like sort of put up this front with his like ego and attitude. And so when he's, we know people that like, you know, like we were saying, when you make a mistake and you can't admit it because it's embarrassing to have messed up or whatever. But then I think that Hawkeye sort of being open with him and yelling at him got through to him a little bit.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, the last time we see Winchester before this scene, it's after Hawkeye leaves him alone on the compound, and they do hold on Winchester for like a beat, suggesting that he is taking that in a little. Like he's realizing, okay, yeah, I, you know, without an audience, you just don't care. And he's like, realize, well, that's, you're not really being a, there's more to being a doctor than just technical skill. So that is something that Winchester is going to pick up on. And as you mentioned, later episodes, he will become very good with some of his patients. In fact, mm-hmm. some of MASH's best medical plot lines in the later seasons are Winchester plot lines, in my opinion. Yeah. The one with the guy who plays the piano, the one with the guy who stutters in the season 11 episode. I mean, those are some of the best ones that the show ever did.
Oh, I totally agree. The one with the piano players. I can't remember the title of the episode, but it's got to be probably one of my favorite episodes of the show.
Yeah, that's a great B-plot. And you know, this will come up again, I'm sure, because we have five more seasons to discuss it. But I like to, I was such a MASH nerd that I liked to sort of like, not fanfic, because fanfic was not a thing, at least that I knew about at the time.
Well, it was a thing.
Well, it was. Okay. I didn't know about it. Let me put it that way. When I was 13 and MASH was off the air, this was the 80s, the Paleozoic era. I didn't know about these things. But I would imagine, like, what would have been really cool MASH spinoffs? And I've always said Sydney Friedman would have been the best MASH spinoff, because who wouldn't want to see that? But another real, I always thought a really interesting MASH spinoff would have been like Boston General with Winchester as the main character. Like I could have seen that as him as the lead, you know, the head of the department with all these other doctors under him. I mean, it would have probably been like a fairly typical medical show, but I thought David Ogden Stiers brought such a great passion and warmth, ironically enough, to the role that I'm like, I could have seen him taking the lead on a MASH spinoff, like an hour long Lou Grant style MASH spinoff, if they had ever wanted to do it.
Oh, absolutely. I would completely have watched that. I think he's maybe my favorite actor on the show. I just think he's so incredible in that character.
Yeah, he's terrific. He said he knew what he was doing. And even though in later episodes of season, again, I think they're kind of darting around with the character, he's always terrific. And then once they finally figure him out, then he really digs into it even further, because he knows, okay, this is who Winchester is, and we can just go for it from here. So anyway, that is the light that failed. So now that we've talked about it, Britt, like, do you feel any differently about the Winchester B plot? You're a little warmer towards it, or is it still kind of like, yeah, I don't know.
I do actually feel better about it. I think you probably could hear me, because as we were talking about it and as we were going through it bit by bit, I was like, oh, geez, I kind of like perjured myself at the beginning being like, oh, because that was just my gut reaction. I think it was a combination of as amazing as I think they both are in that scene, my discomfort with the scene with Charles and Margaret, just it not feeling right for his character. And then I think just all together watching it, I was like, oh, I don't know if I buy it. But then thinking about it bit by bit and thinking about it more in relation with the path that his character goes on later in the show, I'm like, okay, I can see it a little bit more.
Well, there we go. And it was, yeah, it was all worth it.
Turn me around in 30 minutes.
Any of you out there listening, if there are episodes you're dubious about, let me know. We'll go through it bit by bit, and maybe we can turn you around a little bit. So, so all right, as we're wrapping up here, do you have a favorite line or joke from this episode?
Well, I mean, it's hard. I wrote a few down, actually. I mean, I love the superior sturgeon line, and I think don't keep us in suspenders is a great Potterism. But I really do think my favorite line is from the supplies clerk saying, yeah, I used to wonder about stuff like that, but it kept me up at night.
That great line from the Korean surgeon episode where Hawkeye and BJ are going to radar about getting all the material for the North Korean who wants to join the unit. And he says he's from the other side. Other side of what? The other side of the war. And Radar's like, you mean he's from supply? Which is great.
Oh, that's great.
They regard supply as like the enemy almost, because they're so, so difficult to deal with. And of course, the classic Adam's Rib episode where they go and they talk to those guys. That guy's a jerk too. So I was thinking about
Adam's Rib throughout this episode too, actually, because in the scene when they're on the phone with the lady in Australia, I was thinking about Adam's Rib and them calling back for another, you know, sort of arbitrary thing for morale, you know?
Right. Yes.
It's similar, which also it's now you mentioned Radar again. So I haven't been currently like watching the show, and I've seen it through the one time all the way through. And then I've watched a bunch of my favorite episodes over and over again. But because I'm not in the middle of season six, I sort of lose the plot of the timeline for myself because I haven't seen it so many times as you have. And watching this episode, I forgot that Radar is supposed to still be there because I'm so used to Klinger doing the clerk tasks that I almost had a moment in my brain where I snagged on it, where I was like, why is Klinger doing clerk tasks? But he's also not in his uniform, because by the time he's the clerk, he's usually in his uniform. So I was sort of like snagged up on it. And then when I looked back and I was like, oh my God, Radar is supposed to be there. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that Klinger is, you know, already slotting into that role as the clerk there, but it's a supply heavy episode and there's no Radar.
Again, you would think that Klinger would have been able to step into the role quite effectively because he's been doing it a lot, especially in season six, as Gary Berghoff took off more and more episodes. You know, like, come on, how does Klinger not know how to do this? But actually my favorite line is related to that same scene, and it's where the supply truck guy is asking Potter to sign for all the useless supplies. He's got to get to the 8063rd. And Potter says, let him get their inflatable pool and swim fins an hour later, which I just enjoy that. He's imagining like, you delivered a bunch of useless crap to us. Let them get their useless crap later on. That made me chuckle. I'm like, yeah, that's probably what they would get is an inflatable pool and swim fins. Is the stuff that makes the way to South Korea somehow. So, well, that is The Lake That Failed. Britt, thank you so much for joining me. Like I said, you were one of the people that I immediately started to talk to over on MashBlur when we got into, you know, I learned about that whole universe out there. And I said, I just absolutely love that people are rediscovering the show. It's the show landing on Hulu is a bigger thing than I would have guessed. I think because when it finally showed up on Hulu, I was like, well, first of all, I own it on DVD and I own it on iTunes. So it's like, it's always been available to me. And then when it showed up on Hulu, it was just like, oh, well, that's convenient. Now it's on Hulu too. But more and more people that I've talked to that are later fans of it, I say, well, how did you become a fan? They're like, oh, Hulu. So that was actually a really good, whoever's decision that was, I'm assuming Disney owns MASH now and Disney owns a stake in Hulu. MASH isn't going to go on Disney Plus because it's a little too adult. That's kind of what Hulu is for. So, you know, whatever executive or executives made that decision, good on you, because I think you've ensured that MASH will continue to live on for younger fans, because it seems like so many people are finding it on Hulu.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it was huge. I can say for myself, even though I'd heard of it before and everything, I don't think I would have, you know, said, oh, I'm going to watch this entire 11 season show that I've never
all 251
seen
before, episodes
that is going to require me to either, you know, really struggle to seek it out or pay for each individual season, which obviously, you know, now I've got this like $150 DVD set that I've bought because I fell for the show. But it being, I think that happened with a few shows, especially around like pandemic time, people mm-hmm. are home watching TV. I watched it happen with, not as old of a show, but the Avatar, The Last Airbender going to Netflix created a huge resurgence of that fan community for people that hadn't, seen it before. So yeah, I think like, I mean, it is surprising. I think to any, like my parents and my grandparents and stuff, oh my God, I can't believe that you're, mm-hmm. you know, obsessed with MASH. And, you know, I have a bit of a collector's itch, and I'm really into vintage media, and I'm into like vintage magazines especially. And I have framed on my wall in my room a series of like vintage magazines with Alan Alda on the cover that I bought on eBay and framed. And my mom is just in fits about it all the time. She's like, I can't believe you're obsessed with Alan Alda. Like, great. Times never change, Ma.
He was on a lot of magazines back then, too. There's a lot to pick from.
I've got a few People magazines and stuff. Actually, I have one that is, I can't remember the name of it right now. It's in the other room. But one that was a kids publication. And it has Potter and BJ and Hawkeye in the cover. And it was from when the changeover to season 4 is coming. And it says, big letters, new men on MASH! Exclamation mark.
I think that's Dynamite magazine.
It is. It is Dynamite.
Yeah. I had that magazine as a kid. Yeah, totally.
I love that. You know,
yeah.
But yeah, I wanted to, oh my God, you had it as a kid. I bought it on eBay. That's great. Yeah, I wanted to bring up, cause like we're talking about the surprise that younger people are getting into the show and whatnot. My friends were sweet enough to buy me a cameo from Jamie Farr for my birthday.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, it is.
That's great. Awesome. What did he say?
Oh my God. It was an amazing video. He was so genuine. He wished me happy birthday on behalf of my friends. And then very sweetly thanked me for being such a big fan of the show at such a young age. He's just a very, very, it just felt like he actually meant it. Like it felt very genuine. And he made it it's a long video. It's like 2 minutes. He plays like happy birthday on a little, like he has a little cupcake that plays the happy birthday song. He has a giant like doll of Klinger that he does a whole like line about, I don't know, may your days be full of like spit free camels and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was great. Everyone in my family got a real kick out of it. We've watched
it
1,000 times.
Awesome. That is, he is, yes, a very genuine man. Very, very mm-hmm. sweet. So that is fantastic. That's a great, I love it. I love that he's on Cameo too.
I know. I was so surprised when I saw it and I thought it was great that my friends went and sought out such a silly thing for me.
That's, you know what? And you'll never forget it. You know what I mean?
Never. Like
you got to hear your name said by Klinger. You know, it's just a great, it's a great thing. That's awesome. I absolutely love that. That is absolutely fantastic. Well, Britt, thank you so much for doing the show. Why don't you tell people, if you want to, where they can find you out on the internet?
Sure. I'm blessedly freed myself from Twitter recently, so I'm no longer there. But you can find me on Instagram. It's Brittany, BRITTNEY _HC. And that's pretty much where I'm at these days.
Okay. Well, again, thank you so much for reaching out and wanting to do the show. And thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
All right. So, of course, everybody, you can find back episodes, all the back episodes on our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show in any podcatcher of your choice. I foolishly have not freed myself from Twitter, so you can find the show over there at MASH477Cast. And then finally, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, please go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various awards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Daniel Ulrich, Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Mike Thomas, Joe Perino, Billy Shulman, Dennis Bailey, Kara Kay, Tim English, Adam Ackerman, Lisa Pomegranate, Laura Braun, Stefan Van Skyke, and David Mann. Thank you all so much. So that's going to do it. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
All we have to do is call the author. According to the jacket blurb, Abigail Porterfield has been living in Sydney, Australia for the past 60 years.
60 years? How old is she?
97.
We better hurry.